The doctor went on at length about his standing in the field of hypnosis, quote, I am probably the leading expert in the world, and abilities, quote, I can hypnotize everybody in this office in less than 5 minutes, detailed his successes with Henry Bush and Albert DeSalvo, and ventured opinions on various aspects of hypnosis. But when Langman, who had been researching the possibility of assassination through mind control, asked, quote, do you feel that Sirhan could have been self-hypnotized? His expansiveness vanished. I'm not going to comment on that case, Ryan said curtly, because I didn't hypnotize him. When Langman explained that she simply wanted his opinion, Brian exploded, You are going around trying to find some more ammunition to put out that same old crap, he said, that people can be hypnotized into doing all these weird things. He charged out of his office, snapping, This interview is over.
Another interesting thing is presented in the next section of the Turner and Christian discussion of Brian, and we'll sum up some of the key points of this afterward. Shaken by the angry outburst, Langman went across the street for coffee, accompanied by a sympathetic secretary. Langman was in for another shock. According to the secretary, Brian had received an emergency call from Laurel, Maryland, only minutes after George Wallace was shot. The call somehow concerned the shooting. Governor Wallace was shot and badly injured on May 15, 1972, at Laurel while campaigning for the presidency. His assailant was Arthur Bremmer. In the spring of 1977, Brian was found dead in a Las Vegas motel room from natural causes, unquote, the coroner said. Curiously, the word was issued before the official autopsy. Shortly thereafter, we were put in contact with two Beverly Hills call girls who claimed to have known Brian intimately. They had been servicing him on an average of twice a week for 4 years, they said, and usually were present at the same time. During the last year of his life, he was deeply depressed because his paramour had run off with another man. He became strung out on drugs, and his groin and thighs were pocked with bruises from hypodermic needles. No mention of these marks appeared on the coroner's report. The girl said that to relieve Brian's depression, they repeatedly titillated his enormous ego by getting him to, quote, talk about all the famous people you've hypnotized, unquote. As if by rote, Brian would begin with his role of deprogramming Albert DeSalvo in the Boston Strangler case for F. Lee Bailey, then boast that he had hypnotized Sirhan Sirhan. The girls didn't sense anything unusual in the Sirhan angle, for Brian had told them many times that he, quote, worked with the LAPD on murder cases, and they didn't know that he had absolutely no contact with Sirhan following the assassination. One of the girls thought that Brian had mentioned James Earl Ray once, but wasn't sure. Remember James Earl Ray, we'll come back to that in a second. But both girls were certain of the name Sirhan Sirhan. The call girls also linked Brian to the CIA. At the outset of their relationship with him, he instructed them to call an unlisted phone number at his office. If someone else answered, they were to say they were with the company, unquote, an insider's term for the CIA, and they would be put through to him. According to the girls, Brian repeatedly confided that he was not only a CIA agent, but involved in, quote, top-secret projects, unquote. However, when he began bragging about such escapades as crawling over rooftops at night in Europe, they were a bit skeptical. We couldn't see Doc doing that kind of thing. Not all 300 pounds of him, we couldn't, one of the girls said, laughing. Upon Brian's death, his offices were sealed off to newsmen by his estate's probate lawyer, John Miner, who had also helped prosecute Sirhan as a deputy DA. There remains the question of Brian's claimed hypnotist-subject relationship with Sirhan and what role his connection with the CIA might have played in it. But there are a lot of things to pause and ruminate over in this whole passage about William Joseph Brian. First of all, note all the different people connected with this country's assassinations or attempted assassinations who he basically crosses paths with. We see that he, according to his secretary, received a call from Laurel, Maryland in connection with the Wallace shooting. Interesting in light of the fact that a person we talked about in the Guns of November, a guy named the Reverend Jerry Owen, who appears to have been involved with some kind of escape plan with Sirhan. Certainly he was an associate of Sirhan's and appears to have been in a position to drive a pickup truck and take someone, whether it's Sirhan or a double or somebody, away from the Ambassador Hotel on the evening of the shooting. Now, one of his top religious followers, now recall he also was a Bible-thumping fundamentalist, just like William Joseph Brian. Basically, one of Jerry Owen's top religious followers was Arthur Bremmer's sister. Now, recall also that William Joseph Brian is also a member of the same old Roman Catholic Church as David Ferry from the Kennedy assassination. Also very, very interesting. Worth noting, too, that John Minor, who sealed off William Joseph Bryan's estate, turns out to be a deputy DA who prosecutes Ceran. And keep in mind that the instructions given the call girls, that the fact that they were to call an unlisted number and say they were with the company if they wanted to get through to William Joseph Bryan Jr. And there's an awful lot to keep in mind here, and remember that Bryan himself said that he apparently worked with the National Security Establishment. He talked about the fact that during the Korean War, he supposedly helped combat brainwashing. And it's also interesting that the DDD DeSalvo automatic writing by William Joseph Bryan may refer to Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, who was, to a certain extent, found out as a result of Bryan's work with hypnosis.
Okay, now, again, back to the subject of James Earl Ray mentioned briefly earlier in the allegation made by one of the call girls who had supposedly been, quote-unquote, servicing William Joseph Bryan. James Earl Ray, well, as those of you also who listen to the Guns of November and some of our other broadcasts here know that the case of Martin Luther King is probably the most doubtful of all the assassination cases, of all the major assassination cases, that's saying quite a great deal after you've looked at the single bullet theory and the Kennedy assassination. To say that the Martin Luther King is the weakest of the cases is pretty extreme, but it probably is. There is the least amount of evidence tying an alleged assassin to a murder between James Earl Ray and Martin Luther King of virtually any of the major assassinations.
Now recall, too, that William Joseph Bryan Jr., not only, the call girls said that they were convinced that he had talked about hypnotizing Ceran and they were sure about Arthur Bremer, but they also, they weren't sure, but they said they thought that he had been in contact with James Earl Ray. Now, we're going to take a look at James Earl Ray's involvement with hypnosis, possibly, and keep in mind the L.A. connection also.
Right. Now, the point I'm making is that, now, while James Earl Ray, to certainly my way of thinking, and I'm sure most people who have studied the Martin Luther King assassination, James Earl Ray definitely did not fire the shots, could not have fired the shots that killed Martin Luther King. However, James Earl Ray himself, by his own admissions, was involved in the plot in some shape or form, if nothing else, as a scapegoat or a decoy. And it's rather complicated to explain, but basically he felt that he had been set up for the assassination rap. We're going to read a little bit more from Walter Boert's Operation Mind Control. And again, perhaps we're going to entertain the suggestion that there was, again, some type of mind control or hypnotic mental control was used in the James Earl Ray case. Again, Operation Mind Control, Walter Boert. The contradictory history of Ray's activities in Los Angeles led private investigators to consider, as they had in the Oswald case, that there may have been two James Earl Rays. One, the James Earl Ray who had been in prison, was a painfully shy fellow who seldom opened his mouth and hardly ever raised his voice. Fellow inmates found they had a hard time describing him, since he maintained such a low profile. He had been raised dirt poor, had never graduated from a school of any kind, and there is no record of his ever having expressed a political idea about anyone. In Los Angeles, the other James Earl Ray was described as an outgoing fellow. He enrolled in and graduated from bartending school. He became involved in an altercation with a girl in a bar who objected to his making slurs about the black race. He was very conscientious about his appearance and was an impeccable dresser, who even wore expensive alligator shoes, and he was a right-wing politician who conspicuously campaigned for George Wallace. One other bit of evidence gives unity to the contradictions. Ray had been hypnotized while in Los Angeles. It was not mentioned in Ray's trial, and they put that in quotation marks, and well that Walter Boert should, but at the time of his arrest in London, he had in his possession three books on hypnotism: Self-Hypnotism, The Technique and Its Use in Daily Living by Leslie M. LaCroix, How to Cash In on Your Hidden Memory Power by William D. Hersey, and Psycho-Cybernetics by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. Ray had told William Bradford Huey, quote, "I took a course in hypnosis while in L.A. I had read a lot about it in prison on how it was used in dentistry and medicine," unquote. On December 27, 1967, Ray appeared in the office of Dr. Mark Freeman, a psychologist who practiced in Beverly Hills. Bear in mind, this is about 6 months or less before the assassination of Martin Luther King. On November 27, 1967, Ray appeared in the office of Dr. Mark Freeman, a psychologist who practiced in Beverly Hills. Dr. Freeman remembered that Ray, who'd given his real name, asked to be hypnotized because he wanted to sleep better and remember things better. Quote, "This fellow really wanted to improve his mind," Dr. Freeman said. "He had an awe of learning. He had a bent for reading. He didn't fight hypnosis. He learned something." Dr. Freeman told George McMillan, author of The Making of an Assassin, quote, "You've got to keep in mind that I get a lot of angry people around here. A lot of people who come to me want to teach me how to do it. I get a lot of rough stuff around here. I mean psychotic, that stuff. But I couldn't pick up on any of that with Ray. He made a favorable impression on me. He was a good pupil. I'd show him how to go under, and pretty soon he'd be lying on the couch on his back and start talking. I taught him eye fixation, bodily relaxation, how to open himself to suggestion. I gave him lots of positive feelings of confidence." It may have been that Freeman found Ray so suggestible because he had been hypnotized before. His contact with Freeman and other hypnotists, he told Huey he'd been to as many as 8, may have been prompted by an unconscious urge to undo what had already been done to him. A hypnotically induced split personality, one which was programmed to kill upon command, or merely one which was programmed to run away, following his normal pattern, but this time on command. It's easy to program someone to do under post-hypnotic cue what he normally does, and it's a lot easier to program a patsy than it is to program a hitman.
Things now. Keep in mind the William Joseph Bryan Jr. connection, who, according to the prostitutes that serviced him, they said that they thought he had been involved with James Earl Ray. They weren't sure, but it's interesting that they were sure that he was involved with Saran Saran. It's worth noting also that if, as Boward is sort of indicating here, James Earl Ray also was under hypnosis and possibly mind control as well, that he may have functioned in a pattern very similar to Saran Saran. Saran was actually a patsy, even though he confessed, possibly after having been programmed to do so by Dr. Diamond. It's obvious from the physical evidence that he could not have killed Robert Kennedy. Now, it's interesting, too, that James Earl Ray also was involved with mind control. And as Boward indicates here, he may have been a patsy and programmed to confess as well. Another interesting detail is the fact that that book referred to was authored by a man named George McMillan. Now, later, George McMillan married a woman named Priscilla Johnson. Priscilla Johnson had been the first person to interview Lee Harvey Oswald upon his arrival in the Soviet Union. She was listed on a Warren Commission document as a State Department employee. She later was very much involved with Marina Oswald and found a stub of a bus ticket, which was the only physical evidence linking Lee Harvey Oswald to Mexico City. And later on, in a sort of a contemporary note, Priscilla Johnson McMillan was sort of the babysitter, the intelligence babysitter of Svetlana Alilueva, at that time defected daughter of Joseph Stalin. And she also, when Svetlana Alilueva was being held incommunicado, was being sequestered away, she was being held at the home of Priscilla Johnson's parents. So an interesting link up there. Again, note the evidentiary tributaries going between these various assassinations. Possibly here, possibly a link, a hypnosis link between Saran and James Earl Ray. But this is a pattern that we've looked at before. There are a lot of interesting connections between the social milieu surrounding these supposedly lone nuts.
Indeed, and I think that that's the main lesson that we learn from doing this research and doing these broadcasts is that, again, coincidence certainly does exist in the world, and circumstantial evidence in and of itself is not a valid proof in most situations. However, time and time again, we run into conspiracy coincidence, piled on top of conspiracy coincidence to the point almost of the absurd, and again, at a certain point, one has to draw the line and say, well, you know, I'm beginning to doubt that this is all coincidence. And this is indeed more and more what we begin to find in the case of mind control, that just too many things cropping up in too many similar places to entirely discount them as being simply chance. Anyway, What this is going to be is not chance. This is going to be on purpose. We're going to take a short break for a few minutes, and we're going to be back to continue on with the information section. When we do finish the information section, we will be having open phones later tonight. But next, we will be continuing with more information. So don't go away. This is Nip Tuck. I'll be back with Dave Emery in just a few moments as we continue with Radio Free America right here on KFJC. You guessed it, Los Altos Hills. Don't go away now.
The lunatic is on the grass.
This is Nip Tuck, and I'm here in the studio with Dave Emery, and we're going to continue on with the Radio Free America broadcast. And bear with us for some of the strange technical happenings here. This is not a studio that's been used much for two microphones and all this other things and tapes and records and all that. So I may make a couple of funny noises, but we know what we're doing. Honest to goodness, we do.
All righty. Okay. Now, one of the things that has been a major focus of activity vis-a-vis mind control with the intelligence agencies has been using various mind control techniques, and here again hypnosis is front and center, to permit army or intelligence couriers to do a couple of things. First of all, the subconscious mind can assimilate a whole lot more information than the conscious mind and remember it, and this of course enables a hypnotized courier to learn and carry a whole lot more information than someone who is simply operating on the conscious level. On top of that, and perhaps even more importantly, a hypnotized courier who basically has had information placed into his mind, his subconscious mind, and then blocked out of his conscious via post-hypnotic suggestion, that courier cannot be forced to divulge that information. That was a major focus of intelligence activity vis-a-vis mind control and hypnosis. And a little bit of information about that here to give you an idea of just the kinds of things that can be done is contained once again in Walter Borat's Operation Mind Control. Dr. Bernard C. Gindes, G-I-N-D-E-S, wrote of an amnesia experiment he undertook for the U.S. Army in the late 40s. A soldier with only grade school education was able to memorize an entire page of Shakespeare's Hamlet after listening to the passages seven times. Repeating that again, a soldier with only grade school education was able to memorize an entire page of Shakespeare's Hamlet after listening to the passages only seven times. Upon awakening, he could not recall any of the lines, and even more startling was the fact that he had no remembrance of the hypnotic experience. A week later, he was hypnotized again. In this state, he was able to repeat the entire page without a single error. In another experiment to test the validity of increased memory retention, five soldiers were hypnotized en masse and given a jumbled code consisting of 25 words without phonetic consistency. They were allowed 60 seconds to commit the list to memory. In the waking state, each man was asked to repeat the code. None of them could. One man hazily remembered having had some association with a code, but he could not remember more than that. The other four soldiers were allowed to study the code consciously for another 60 seconds, but all denied previous acquaintance with it. During rehypnotization, they were individually able to recall the exact content of the coded message. So here we see one of the fantastic uses of hypnosis and mind control for the for the intelligence agencies and military. Look at how much more a mind-controlled courier can assimilate than someone who can't.
Oh, I was just going to mention that now. Bear in mind too that quite a bit of this stuff. Now, the more sinister aspects of mind control obviously are things where some of this is still still speculation, or it's still things that are the firsthand reports of people involved. A lot of the other stuff about the military use of hypnosis for encryptification, I guess, which would be the transmission of codes and things of that nature, is quite well documented. This is not stuff that these people are making up as they're going along. In other words, almost all of the basic techniques that we're talking about tonight are already in existence and have been in existence for quite some time. The question for even the most skeptical listener is not whether they exist or not, but whether they have been put to use in the fashion that we're talking about tonight, and we believe that they have.
Okay, now a mind control courier who we referred to earlier and who we're going to talk about at some length right now was a woman named Candy Jones. During the 1940s, Candy Jones was probably second only to Benny Grable as a pinup girl for the GIs overseas during World War II. After the war, she became a very successful model, eventually running her own model agency. She also became a CIA courier and was one of these people who had messages locked away in her subconscious and then could only divulge the information after the proper cue was given to break up the post-hypnotic suggestion or dissolve it. Now, we're going to tell you a little bit about Candy Jones. Her story was authored by a man named Donald Bain, B-A-I-N. He wrote a book called The Control of Candy Jones. That was published in both hardcover and softcover by the Playboy Press and was copyrighted in 1976. And one of the things that we're going to look at here, we've looked at the basic methodology used for mind control couriers, and that comprises a good portion of the Candy Jones story. A couple of the interesting things about Candy, first of all, is the fact that when the CIA was apparently through with her services and she married New York talk show host Long John Neble, a major figure on the New York radio scene in the 60s and 70s, and apparently this caused her to run afoul of the agency, and they made arrangements for her to commit suicide. Now, a word of explanation, you're going to hear references to Candy and to Arlene Grant. Now, Arlene Grant is a second personality that was hypnoprogrammed into Candy Jones by her CIA control. In this book by Donald Bain, the CIA controllers are not referred to by their real names. They're referred to by two pseudonyms, Dr. Gilbert Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, and Dr. Marshall Berger, B-U-R-G-E-R. So those are the references to those two individuals you're going to hear. Neither of them are the real people. Now, they're both real people, but those are not their real names, okay? Now, Candy Jones basically, when she was a child, she made up an imaginary playmate with whom she used to play, because I guess, according to the book, she did not have a whole lot of playmates her own age. This imaginary playmate was a woman named a girl named Arlene Grant. Now, what her hypnoprogrammer and controller, the man under the pseudonym of Gilbert Jensen, did was to program Candy in such a way as that her intelligence functions were basically assumed by a woman named Arlene Grant. So when Candy was functioning under control and under hypnosis and mind control, it was actually Arlene Grant who handled most of the activities. And it's worth noting that when Candy was very frightened, one of the things she used to do when she was a little girl was to sort of have Arlene be her big sister and protector, so that Arlene, in the hypnoprogrammed Candy, became the recipient of many of the strong and even aggressive qualities that Candy herself lacked or felt she lacked. But that's the reference to Arlene Grant that you're going to hear here. And it's worth noting also that the way that Candy was deprogrammed to the extent that she was, her husband, Long John Neble, hypnotized her initially to help her get over some insomnia, and apparently the hypnoprogrammed personality Arlene Grant and Candy's own experiences while under hypnosis were able to come out under the hypnotic sessions run by Long John Neble. Now, these sessions were taped at some length, and most of the sections of Candy Jones that we're going to be reading here consist of transcriptions of those tapes made by her husband, Long John Neble. So that'll give you an idea of what Candy was about and what some of the names are that you're going to hear here.
Okay. Now, bear in mind too that this was deep hypno programming, and that John Neble was not able to get this all out on the first time that he tried this. This came out over a long, long period of time and quite a bit of work. Bear in mind also that what we're talking about in this case, that a lot of times when he's talking to the personality of Arlene, personality of Arlene, this is through a thing that's called hypnotic regression. They have in fact regressed in time to where the personality responding, whether it be Candy or her alter ego, think that they are back in the time that they have been told they are in, and then they therefore repeat what they see. This is a very common hypnotic practice that's used by, as I mentioned earlier, they did that on Sirhan and found him reaching to a left side of his belt for a gun that he thought was there because he thought he was back on the night of the assassination. Police do this all the time. It's a very common hypnotic process. Anyway, this particular session, Neble has regressed the Arlene personality back to a time when she was in Miami, that Candy had traveled to Miami, and then the Arlene personality had taken over. Okay, and so this is going on in the present, but the event had taken place in the past. John says, "Do you like Candy?" meaning the person, Arlene, insolently, with almonds. John, are you brave, Arlene? Arlene, not brave, just stupid and strong and fast. John, isn't Candy strong? Arlene, she's strong, but not as fast as me. John, did Jensen, again, that's the CIA doctor, did Jensen ever suggest to you that you commit suicide? Arlene, he can't get rid of me that fast. I won't let her or him. John, well, if Candy dies, you're dead. Arlene, Candy doesn't know that. John, do you think Candy would ever kill herself? Arlene, it's not called killing. It's stopping what is. John, what does that mean? Arlene, condescendingly, it means stopping the progression of a positive action. John, that doesn't make any sense. Arlene, it's the stopping of movement. John, you mean death? Arlene, yes, of course. John, would you like to be dead, Arlene? Arlene, I am. John, if you're dead, how can you talk? Arlene, why don't you die and find out? Nebel and Arlene continued to talk about Candy and her state of mind at the moment. Arlene told him that Candy was in very deep trouble with Jensen, and that Jensen was looking for Candy. What will Jensen do if he finds Candy? John asked. Make her commit suicide? No, Arlene replied, but Candy might kill herself. She might. In another undated hypnotic session, Nebel had an opportunity to ask Candy if she thought Jensen would ever harm her. Candy had regressed, and John was playing the role of her alter ego.
John, do you ever think your life is in danger? Candy, my life is in danger 24 hours a day, and I am exhausted. I just want to lie down and rest. John, why do you do this if it puts you in danger and exhausts you? Because Jensen tells you to do it? He's not your friend. He's done you a lot of harm. Candy, he won't kill me. John, why not? Candy, he's not going to do anything unless he can make it look accidental. John, are you saying that he would kill you if he could make it look like an accident? Candy, no, he wouldn't do it yet because it could be traced to him. Nebel was unable to gain any further information during this session, but was successful at a later date in learning more about his wife's supposed last assignment, unquote. As session after session unfolded, more details of Jensen's plan to have Candy commit suicide surfaced. It was to occur in December of 1972. Jensen had booked a first-class seat for her on Pan Am to Nassau, the Bahamas. She would check into the Paradise Beach Hotel, where she'd been a frequent visitor over the years as Candy Jones. But Arlene Grant would meet her there. That was part of Jensen's plan. He told Candy that she would receive a call during her second day on the island. She asked him who would be calling her, but he refused to tell her. I assume it was to be Jensen himself who would call, and his call would cause Arlene to take over from Candy and guide her to a steep bluff overlooking the sea. Arlene would make the high dive just as she had done when they were children, and it would be over for Candy Jones. Did you know that Arlene planned to kill you in the Bahamas? Nebel asked Candy during a hypnotic session in July of 1973. Yes. What had you done to make her that angry with you? It's all too complicated, Candy replied. I was told to meet her there. Where? The Bahamas. The Paradise Beach Hotel. When did this happen? Nebel asked. Last November. That's when I was told. Nebel asked Arlene about the incident during a regression that took place in their apartment on an unspecified date. Candy is just a dragnet around your neck, Arlene told Nebel, but she needed you. She had all the time in the world to go to Paradise Island in December and take the high dive, but she married you. If Candy killed herself, Arlene, you would be dead too. Oh, no, replied Arlene. I'd be the one who'd survive. Jensen had persuaded Arlene of that. What about Candy's marriage to John, Arlene? Have you been deliberately trying to ruin the marriage? Arlene laughed her bitter, harsh laugh. What do you mean, tried? I did ruin it, unquote. Candy's marriage to John Nebel on December 31, 1972, precluded her taking the trip to the Bahamas. But although it was a heartening incident in that it perhaps indicated that with sufficient motivation, Candy was able to counter certain of Jensen's instructions, it did not signal the end of all control Gilbert Jensen had established over her. His presence pulled at her throughout the early years of the marriage, and on many occasions threatened to smash it to pieces, as certainly she herself would have been smashed had she leaped from the bluff in Nassau. So, just as we saw with George de Morangeld, just as we apparently saw with Mr. Castillo from the Kennedy assassination, and just as we have seen in other examples, the sort of stereotyped MK-Ultra assassin was supposed to commit suicide afterward. Candy Jones was going to be silenced forever as a result, basically using hypnosis. And it's worth noting that the strong Arlene Grant had assumed such a degree of autonomy as a separate personality that Jensen had convinced her that she would not die with Candy, which is an indication of just what can be done here. And something else that comes to mind, you know, these days there's been a lot of focus on the efforts by the Reagan administration to muzzle federal employees, not only while they're working for the federal government, but also afterward, in order to prevent disclosure of any information which the authorities don't want disclosed. It's worth, I think, examining this in light of that. Certainly, getting employees, key employees, to commit suicide under mind control would be an excellent, excellent means of silencing them forever. And who knows, maybe we'll see a lot of State Department employees and a lot of other people committing suicide and otherwise disposing of themselves, committing suicide and silencing themselves if Reagan's efforts are not successful.
Well, we certainly saw a lot of interesting quote-unquote suicides during, say, the Ed Wilson case, a lot of suicides and near suicides and things of that nature. Okay, skipping along, a segment that comes up in the Control of Candy Jones has to do with John Neville's discovery under hypnosis of some rather odd training besides the regular sort of CIA courier training that Candy Jones underwent under the hypnoprogramming by Dr. Gilbert Jensen, again, a pseudonym. John Neville found that that Candy responded very strangely to certain people, ways that he thought were anomalous, especially to friends of his, for no particular reason that he could figure out. Well, as he continued this hypno deprogramming, he began to find more and more that there had been apparently specific hate training, is the term that Donald Bain uses in The Control of Candy Jones, by the mind control experts on Candy Jones herself, actually training her to hate whole groups of people. Now, after we finish reading some of these segments, we'll speculate a little bit on what that might mean. Anyway, again, from The Control of Candy Jones, in an hypnotic session recorded on April 10th, 1974, Arlene, again, that's Candy's dual personality, Arlene emerged in an angry, bitchy mood. After berating Candy for 2 minutes, and after claiming that Candy's mother was, quote, crazy as a hoot owl, and bragging that she had accompanied Candy to visit her mother in the hospital and had made some comments that drove Candy's mother out of her mind, Arlene got into the business of what she and Candy had been taught by Gilbert Jensen. She referred to Candy's mother's doctor as a, quote, kike. She was laughing cruelly throughout this session and began to repeat with apparent glee, kike, kike, kike. She told Neville that the doctor was the kind of kike that he, meaning Neville, would have on his radio show. She said that the kinds of kikes Neville was friendly with were the obnoxious and aggressive types. She then said scornfully, quote, Candy doesn't even have enough sense to know when they're pigs. She continued her tirade against the Jews and, approximately 15 minutes into the recorded session, bragged that Gilbert Jensen had told her, Arlene, that she should not like Jews. Later in this session, at approximately 19 minutes, Arlene denied having said that Jensen instructed her to hate Jews, but she quickly added, quote, Jews are bad. In a session recorded in January 1974, Candy mentioned that Arlene got along very nicely with Gilbert Jensen. She indicated that one of the reasons Jensen liked Arlene was that Arlene thought the way he did and was willing to take his advice. John Neville asked Candy what ethnic groups Jensen considered dangerous. Candy, quote, the Jewish people, of course, he called them kikes, and the American niggers, as he called them. He always used the name niggers. You know, he was Jewish himself, but he didn't like me to tell him that. He said there was a difference between Jews. John, before you met Jensen, how did you feel about people of the Jewish faith? Candy, I didn't feel anything. Then in parentheses it says, according to Candy, she had had many close Jewish friends and business associates prior to becoming involved with Jensen and the CIA.
Still a little later, Donald Bain continues with Neville's account of the hate training that Candy Jones received. Neville, still playing Jensen, asked, "Do you hate me?" "I only hate things that are worth hating," Arlene replied. "You taught me that." "I'm not worth hating, is that it?" "You should know, you taught me everything." "Okay, Arlene." Arlene repeated a motto that Jensen had obviously used on many occasions. "Only hate that which is worth hating." "Well, that's good advice, isn't it?" Neville asked. "Yeah, especially since almost everything is worth hating, according to you." "I never said you should hate everything, did I?" "You hate yourself," Arlene told Jensen. "You hate just about everybody and everything." "I never told you to hate everything," Neville said in his role as Gilbert Jensen. "It all boils down to that," said Arlene. "You told me that there was hate in everybody, and sooner or later it would come out."
Okay. Skipping along, he then asked her whether she had attended one of Berger's classes in California. Now, Berger is another prep programmer that was being used at the time by the CIA, and we're going to find out about those classes in a moment. He then asked her whether she had attended one of Berger's classes in California. She said she had. Neville asked her whether it was an ethnic hate class. Quote, "It's his regular lecture," Candy said. "He also lectures on hypnosis," Neville asked. Candy agreed. Neville then asked her what Berger generally said in his ethnic group classes. Quote, "I don't know. He said you have to be careful about what you say to certain types of people." The ethnic attitudes instilled in Candy by Jensen and Berger were as distasteful as those represented by the crudest of today's ethnic, quote, humor. Because of Candy's high ratings on scent tests, there appears to have been an emphasis placed upon what Berger claimed were peculiar odors emitted by various ethnic groups. In a session recorded on April 13, 1974, at 8 o'clock p.m., Candy mumbled something about black people having a peculiar smell. Neville asked her whether she truly believed that black people had an odor. Candy, "To me, they do." That's what he said. John, "Jensen told you that?" Candy, "Sure, I took the test." John, "And you found that black people smell?" Candy, "Sure, he identified them for me." John, "Do Jews smell?" Candy, "They have bad perspiration. Anybody does." John, "Then everyone smells the same." Candy, "They," meaning the Jews, "eat that kind of food and then they have that perspiration smell." John, "Did Jensen tell you that?" Candy, "He said that they eat highly seasoned stuff and then they perspire, especially if they're fat." John, "What about the Italian people? Do they smell?" Candy, "They smell of garlic, usually Latin smell of garlic." John, "Did he tell you not to mingle with those people?" "He said not to mingle with any of them. He said that was the way to avoid trouble." Neville then asked her what kind of people Jensen allowed her to associate with.
Candy, "He never said. He told me that I was a good loner and should stay away from all people. He told me that I was self-sufficient and didn't need anybody, and that I would be much better off being alone." John, "Arlene said that you were programmed to hate people. Candy, I don't like her. She gives me stomach aches." Interrupting here, recall that both Castillo and Saran, under the effects of questioning while under hypnosis, professed to have stomach aches. And one of the things that the hypno-programmers of Candy did was that they taught her to have Arlene Grant come up out of her stomach. Continuing here. Later in the same session, when Candy was struggling to keep Arlene inside, Neville asked whether Jensen had taught Arlene to dislike black people. Candy said that Jensen had told Arlene to be careful because blacks could be dangerous, and he had said the same thing about Jews. She added during the latter portion of this session that Puerto Ricans were also not to be trusted. There are indications from the hypnotic session tapes that Gilbert Jensen had negative feelings about the black race long before he began indoctrinating Candy with those feelings. There are two hypnotic sessions in which Neville regressed Candy back to her South Pacific days with Gilbert Jensen, and in both sessions she talked to Jensen about incidents involving black soldiers. In one session, according to the hypnotized Candy, Jensen told her she had better stay away from black soldiers because they would rape her. He also told her during their World War II days in Leyte that she must be very careful of people, particularly blacks, and that they must be closely observed for a clue as to what their motivations and actions might be. This prejudice preached by Gilbert Jensen during World War II, and more pointedly, as part of his CIA programming of Candy, is particularly unfortunate because of her natural inclinations had always been quite the opposite. Hers was among the first modeling agencies to actively promote and use black models. She numbered among her friends many Jews and had apparently lived her life with an admirably open mind toward minority groups. But once the programming took effect, she found herself acting contrary to her inherent beliefs. On an undated tape, she talked to John Neville, her alter ego, about what Jensen had told her concerning Negroes. According to the tape, Jensen had repeatedly asked her to tell him the names of her friends in New York and expressed his dissatisfaction with the fact that one of Candy's secretaries was a black girl who had been with Candy for 4 years. "Get rid of that girl," Jensen told her. "She's talking about you around town," unquote. Jensen then took out a snapshot he claimed he had taken of the black secretary outside the office building at 52 Vanderbilt Avenue in New York City. Candy was shocked that Jensen had been there and had taken the picture, and expressed her feelings to him. Jensen again insisted that she fire the girl, which Candy eventually did with mixed emotions. Another aspect of Candy's training had to do with observing people's mannerisms. Jensen gave her a pamphlet, the title of which she recalls was The Human Face, unquote. She claims, under hypnosis, to have studied it as instructed and to have found the material helpful. The hypnotic session in which this booklet was mentioned took place in October of 1974. Neville played the role of Jensen.
Okay. John, do you remember how I taught you to look at a person and you know something about him? Bear in mind, John is playing the role of Jensen. Candy, you gave me the book, meaning the pamphlet. John, surprised, do you remember the title? Candy, without hesitation, The Human Face. John, who wrote it, remember? Candy, Brophy or someone like that. John, that's right, you've got a good memory. Did you study it? Candy, oh yes, it's so true, you can see it's true. I never thought of it that way. The weakness in the chin, the earlobes, the shape of the ear, the forehead, the placement of the eyes. All of this programming by Jensen and Berger was to be culminated, however, in a most extraordinary discussion class conducted by Berger in a small Texas town very close to the Louisiana border. This material came out on tape in early November 1974 and is contained in the transcripts of a hypnotic session between John Neville and Candy Jones. The hypnotic session began with Candy discussing Arlene. Arlene then emerged and said she was waiting for word from someone that would send her into action. Candy had complained at the very beginning of the session that her stomach hurt. Arlene told Neville that Candy had been poisoned, and Arlene suggested that the poison was in something Candy had recently eaten. Neville was unable to elicit further information about this, and the session proceeded to other topics. There was also regression back to Candy's childhood. Neville commented into the microphone that Candy had the most severe pain in her abdomen that he had ever witnessed, and that she was almost crying. She had also complained of leg pains. Neville worked to take away the pain, and succeeded after 3 minutes. Suddenly, Arlene's voice came through, and she told Neville about the severity of the pains Candy had just experienced. Quote, "I can't stand that stuff," Arlene said. Neville assumed she was referring to something she had been drinking, perhaps orange juice, in Jensen's office, and asked her about it. "It tastes just like boiled laundry," replied Arlene. "I ate the food in the test kitchen." Arlene then mumbled something that sounded to Neville like ugly. "Who is ugly?" he asked. "All of them. They eat this stuff. Maybe that's why they look like they do. They say you are what you eat. Can you come up with something that I could order and that I could eat? Something I can stand? Can you have plain rice? Would that be suspicious? Would it look strange? I could say I have a bad stomach or something." And Candy returned. "John, where are you now? What building are you in?" Candy, "I'm in the test kitchen, in the test lab." John, "What city are you in?" Candy, "There's no city." John, "What country then?" Candy, laughing, "You mean what state?" John, "Yes." Candy, "Texas."
And still later. Moments later, Candy, who was lying in bed throughout these hypnotic sessions, sat up and began yelling, "Caucasians are not the concubines of the blacks." Neville was shaken by this sudden outburst and tried to calm her. "It is revolting and it is disgusting," Candy screamed. "John, who told you to say that?" Candy. Gil Jensen, "said to just look around and I'd see it, and I do see it." Her voice still strident. "Does a lion mate with a tiger?" John, do you know where you are right now? Candy, yes, I'm in the discussion class in the building outside of, I don't know where it is, Texas, Louisiana, Texas, on the border. John, who is your instructor? Candy, Dr. Berger. John, that's the man you met in Chicago? Candy, I met him years ago. Suddenly whispering, I'm not supposed to say that. John, and he's the one that, Candy, shh. John, why should I be quiet? Candy, I met him once before, but he pretends he doesn't know me. John, and he's the one giving you instructions in class? Candy, it's just his discussion class. John, is it about blacks and whites? Candy, blacks and whites and yellows and the whole thing. Integration is one thing, but mixed breeding is another. He is so right. John, do you agree with him? Candy, oh yes. John, what else has he said in today's discussion class? Candy, he said it is always the minority group that tries to get the majority group to go with him. It'll be the blacks trying to get the whites to go with them, and the yellows trying to get the whites to go with them. It'll always be that way. Those people are very strong. John, where did you learn that? From Dr. Berger? Candy, uh-huh. And I read it in the literature they give you. John, what were some of the things they gave you? Do you remember? Candy, world power, world peace. Peace is not a color or something like that. Becoming animated. You go to the back of the room there, and they have the booklets on that little table. It's all free, and you can just take any ones you want. How many people were in the discussion class? Candy, 8 or 9 of us today. John, and Dr. Berger is the main speaker? Candy, yeah, they expected a whole lot of people, but something happened to the bus. John, has Gil Jensen been here? Candy, oh, yes. He introduced him. John, he introduced you to Berger? Candy, no, he introduced Berger to the class. He was the moderator of the class and introduced Berger. There is a break in the hypnotic session at this point. When it resumes, it appears to be Candy speaking, but her voice has taken on Arlene's familiar, militant, grating tone. Candy, the black people will take over as much as they can. They will first get their white women and bring in as many offspring as they can. These people are going to be taking the white women and it'll be integration. It is wrong. John, is that what Dr. Berger said? Candy, oh yes, and it is wrong. It will happen. Berger told the whole thing and it makes sense. Neville comments into the microphone that Candy is sitting up in bed, her face twisted into a hateful sneer. John, it makes sense to you? Candy, of course it does.